You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this session, we're going to be looking at the Scottish Trauma Network with Martin Esposito. So what I want to do in the conversation is examine the way in which trauma is both managed and reported throughout Scotland. So the Scottish Ambulance Service, or SAS, receives over 1.5 million calls a year and responds to over 500,000 emergency incidents a year. So in this episode, we wanted to discuss the Scottish Trauma Audit Group, or STAG, as a national audit group within the Scottish National Audit Programme of Public Health Scotland. So STAG measures and is tasked to improving the quality of care, overall experience and long-term outcome of patients with significant injuries and or trauma throughout Scotland. So in the conversation, we always want to examine the Advanced Practitioner in Critical Care Scheme in Scotland. So how it's developed, how it's managed, and some of the recent adaptations according to the need throughout Scotland. So we're also going to look at the need for key interventions when critical care is not available. So to do this, I have Martin Esposito with me. Martin is a consultant paramedic for major trauma within SAS. In this role, he is the lead for all the major trauma work within SAS and is also a line manager for the Advanced Paramedic and Critical Care Scheme. So as well as trauma, he has a special interest in pain management and is the SAS lead for pain management, as well as being an honorary tutor for Cardiff University. Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks for inviting me. And it's been a long time. It's nice to speak to you.
I wonder if we could just start, Martin, by getting to speak to an overview of how pre-hospital care for major trauma works in Scotland.
Yeah, of course. Trauma in Scotland is overseen by the Scottish Trauma Network, or the STN, which was set up by the Scottish Government in 2017 and went live nationally in 2021. And I suppose the overall aim of the STN is similar to other trauma networks around the world, and that the aim is to ensure the best possible care for trauma patients. From a pre-hospital perspective, this probably actually starts before any emergencies with prevention. And then before we actually get to the scene, by identification or identifying that trauma from the large amounts of emergency calls that the ambulance service receives, then it's trying to get the right resource to that patient. You know, that might include enhanced or advanced resources and ensuring the best possible care at the scene. And that we get the right skill sets for those patients. Then it's about triaging to definitive care, or if that's not possible, to the most appropriate receiving unit. And then whilst our focus today is probably going to be talking about pre-hospital element, the network approach is then to provide, you know, the best in-hospital care followed by early and extensive rehabilitation. And to try and get that patient back to their, to get their life back, to get them back to their loved ones and get them back contributing to society. So I think more specifically around the pre-hospital care element in Scotland, this generally starts with our critical care desk, or our CCD, which is an advanced practice-led desk in our ambulance control centre, where we have advanced practitioners in critical care or advanced retrieval practitioners working as part of a team with dedicated coordinators looking for trauma, or in fact any potentially critically ill patients, and dispatching enhanced or advanced resources. And our CCD follows a medical model. And what I mean by that is that we believe that by having ambulance clinicians that have the most experience of responding or managing major trauma critically ill patients, they are the best people to be looking for trauma and supporting clinicians and supporting operational ambulance clinicians. So along with our dedicated non-clinical coordinators, they become quite a pretty powerful team that supplements, I suppose, the standard triage and management of incoming emergency calls that the ambulance service receives in Scotland. And that CCD is, you know, is available to provide clinical advice and support to ambulance clinicians. So that's identification. And in terms of the pre-hospital response, you know, we in Scotland, we divide our trauma response into three tiers or colours. So our green response is our standard ambulance response that, you know, some of your listeners may know. You know, an accident happens, someone phones for an ambulance and we dispatch an ambulance. And whilst I've termed that as our standard response, similar to probably other areas of the UK and other areas of the world, our frontline ambulance resources are now equipped with things like blast dressings, hemostatic dressings, chest seals, tourniquets, traction splints. And, you know, paramedics are able to administer TXA and prophylactic antibiotics for open fractures. But our next tier up is what we would term our yellow tier wound, and that's our enhanced tier. And these are clinicians that can add just a bit more than the standard ambulance response. And this includes pharmacological interventions, such as ketamine for analgesia or sedation, but also surgical interventions, such as thoracostomies and surgical airways. And these are just a couple of examples of the increasing range of skills of our yellow tier, but they also bring that added clinical leadership, expertise and support to the scene. And that yellow tier are generally our advanced practitioners in critical care, or APCCs as we call them, but that also includes some of our basic Scotland responders, our volunteers, and the PICT team, which is a team based in Inverness. And finally, our red tier of response is our physician-led pre-hospital critical care teams. And in Scotland, we currently have four of those teams, or red teams. And we have the EMRS West team based in Glasgow, the EMRS team based in, EMRS North team based in Aberdeen. And they're part of the Scottish Ambulance Services, Scotstar Retrieval Service. So they're dedicated standalone teams that respond to primary missions, such as major trauma incidents, as well as their core retrieval work across Scotland. We also have the Tayside Trauma Team based in Nine Wells Hospital in Dundee and Medic One based in Edinburgh. And both Tayside and Medic One are hospital-based teams where a consultant and a nurse responds from ED as and when required. But all of those red teams can provide advanced pre-hospital care interventions, including RSI, blood transfusion, thoracotomy, and a range of analgesics. And those teams also form an integral part of our major incident plan in Scotland by providing the medical incident officer cover at those incidents. So apologies, Owen, there may have been a lot there, but just to summarise, we've got a dedicated advanced practice-led critical care desk to identify critically ill patients and support our ambulance clinicians in three levels of response, depending on the severity of the incident.
That makes sense, actually. And like you said, it you can escalate through those. And also, they can probably feed into each other if there is a major incident, or indeed some incident which where demand outstrips supply. But Martin, we were just speaking offline, actually, around the emergence of the advanced practitioner and critical care scheme within Scotland. And the phraseology you just used there, I was trying to listen very intently to your words around critically ill patients. Now, that this is encompassing of trauma and medical. I'm going to get you to speak to the initial reason for the inception of the scheme, but to my mind, in London, it was very much this paired response of acute medical and acute trauma, because both are complex, both can really stretch the system, and actually you can see those second and third order effects of both. Support to the staff for whatever extremely difficult patients, but also, like you said, gold standard care, fundamentally doing the basics well for these patients. And as you said before, at the point of call, so the dispatch is absolutely key, one of the fundamental key tenets of this scheme and any other advanced practice scheme is having that embedded practitioner in the dispatch room so they can guide and steer resources to the right patient. But can I get you to speak to, from your perspective, because you have been there since the inception of the scheme, could I get you to speak to the initial reason for the inception of the advanced paramedic scheme?
Yeah, of course. And just before I suppose I answer that, just to go back to your first point. So the advanced practice and critical care scheme is funded through our Scottish, for our trauma, our work. But they do go to a lot of medical stuff, probably similar to what you just described in London. They go to a significant amount of non-trauma or medical patients. And, you know, we see that as advantageous. We see that as really good. I mean, ultimately, it's improving care for patients. And it's that sort of added benefit of having a trauma network. It just doesn't impact positively trauma patients, it impacts medical patients as well. That's got to be a good thing. But going back to, you know, the reasons for why we have the advanced practitioners in critical care in Scotland. When we were discussing the pre-hospital care element of the Scottish Trauma Network, there are a few elements or points that we had to consider. And as you'll know from your experience, so in major trauma it's a relatively low incidence but high consequence disease, So it's something that in general our standard ambulance clinicians won't see very often. So we wanted to find a way to provide the best pre-hospital care to our major trauma patients and support standard operational ambulance clinicians. And secondly, we only have four pre-hospital critical care teams or red teams. And as well as responding to primary taskings, our EMRS teams, their core role is to retrieve critically unwell patients from all over Scotland. And the hospital-based red teams are clearly working in busy emergency departments. So we have to use them carefully. And so thirdly, we believe that there was some patients that required more than what can currently be provided by a standard ambulance response that didn't require that those red skills such as RSI or anaesthesia. And we believe that we've actually shown that a new cohort of autonomous advanced practice ambulance clinicians could provide those additional interventions. And by targeting them at the big sick patients, they would become specialists, experts at managing those critically ill patients. And they can also provide the support to paramedics, to technicians and other grades of ambulance clinician. And finally, Owen, I think what was really important for us was career development. Pre-hospital care is unique. It's a unique speciality, I would argue. And managing critically ill patients can sometimes require skills and interventions beyond the paramedic skill set. Therefore, we were keen to develop a pathway for ambulance clinicians and others to develop and progress in the specialist area.
Absolutely. And to that point, there is a robust development program. It is prudent, like you said, to offer career pathways and indeed career progression for paramedics. And this is a fantastic way to stay clinical, but also improve those clinical reasoning skills and the autonomy. And could I just get you to speak initially to the sort of the base of operation at what from an advanced paramedic or advanced practitioner critical care scheme, where do they cover and indeed what's the area that they serve?
Yeah, of course. Trauma in Scotland, not unsurprisingly, I suppose, tends to follow the areas of greater population, and the greatest population density in Scotland is the central belt, then up our east coast. So the central belt is a sort of east-west area of land that generally encompasses Glasgow and Edinburgh and everything around those and in between them. And that's probably not the best description of the central belt. But that's not to say that trauma doesn't happen elsewhere, but it's where the greatest amount of populations and the greatest amount of trauma happens. So we have two APCC teams based within that central belt, and that's our west team based in Glasgow and our southeast team based on the outskirts of Edinburgh. We have seven APCCs in each of those teams, and as well as their operational shifts, both of those teams work on and rotate through our critical care desk or CCD that I mentioned earlier. And both those teams are based very close to motorways or A roads. And whilst most of their work does tend to be in Glasgow or Edinburgh, those locations do allow for quite a large geographical range. I suppose like any specialist resource or advanced resource, we try and utilise them appropriately to the instance where we think they'll have the most benefit. And as you'll know, there's a number of variables that we have to consider, depending on the nature of the incident. We may choose not to dispatch them. We certainly wouldn't want, in certain situations, our ambulance crews waiting on scene with a critically ill patient when it might be more sensible to get moving. But that said, our southeast team, they attend incidents in West Lothian, Forth Valley, Fife, and right down to the Scottish borders. And our Glasgow-based team are often in Ayrshire, Dumbartonshire, and out towards Lanarkshire. So they both cover large geographical areas. And we also have a team based in Inverness. There are undoubtedly geographical challenges in some of our rural and remote areas all over Scotland, and this includes the north of Scotland. We've got that red team, that EMRS North team based in Aberdeen, and they have access to one of the Scottish Charity Air Ambulances. And we have the EMRS West team that can cover some of the Western Isles and Western areas of Highlands. However, the Invernessshire area is fairly densely populated, but is fairly remote in terms of that red team cover. Therefore, we decided to base our North APCC team in Inverness. So there's six in that team, And as well as providing autonomous APCC cover, they also form part of the PIC team, which is a doctor practitioner yellow tier response based in Inverness. And I think it's probably important to note that in some ways, whilst we would like to increase the number of APCCs, from a safe practice perspective or maintenance of competencies, or I suppose preventing that skill degradation is so, so important. And so for us, maintaining competence is a fine balance between the number of practitioners and the number of incidents where enhanced skills are required. Have we got it right? I'm not sure yet. But what we don't want is advanced practitioners out there who are not utilising their skills regularly. So we've got no immediate plans to increase beyond those three teams at the moment. And I suppose what I should say then, after saying just that, while we can't have APCCs everywhere, we are cognizant of the need to support remote and rural clinicians, and in fact, all of our ambulance clinicians. So we've introduced some of our newer paramedic interventions to more rural areas. So we've introduced Penthrox first, you know, to our rural clinicians before anywhere else. We've developed that critical care desk, so there's support available when required. And we've actually been able to change some of our patient group directives in Scotland for some of our medications to allow paramedics to administer medications with top cover. And an example of that is we've recently changed Armodazolam PGD so that we can give it for agitated patients, head injury patients, or any agitation with top cover support from our critical care desk.
So Martin, that's fantastic. And we're actually going to progress on to STAG shortly and to just look at reporting and audit within Scotland. Just before we do, one of my last questions really would be around how you've approached and fostered this cohort of critical thinking and decision-making and clinical reasoning around the scheme. And I guess that is a segue maybe into governance and, you know, dissecting incidents and how people have approached it from a critical reasoning and critical thinking perspective. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I suppose what you're asking about is clinical reasoning and thinking and decision making around the advanced practitioners. Okay, so I suppose at a sort of fundamental level, we've developed a bespoke advanced practice program with Glasgow Caledonian University for the academic element of the education for our trainee APCCs. So they will come out with a postgraduate diploma level qualification, but we're currently also supporting them to carry on and funding them to carry on and complete their MSc if they wish to do so. And whilst the modules, not surprisingly, are significantly clinically focused, there is an underlying theme of gaining an understanding of clinical decision-making, you know, that system one, system two thinking or reasoning, and the associated biases or advantages or disadvantages are, I suppose, pros or cons. So this cohort of clinician is dispatched to our sickest patients, and they often have to make clinical decisions fairly rapidly. Therefore, there is a lot of sim work and a lot of drilling, which frees up a bit of cognitive space for more complex tasks or decision-making. But that's also supported by cognitive aids. And one of them is we have a bespoke APCC handbook, which has been developed by the APCCs themselves. And that contains concise guidance on some of their specific interventions and the skills relevant to their role. So there's that sort of clinical decision making, there's a sim work, and there's also those cognitive aids. And we also promote peer review. And whilst it's probably achieved rather informally at the moment, to be fair, there is space on their rosters to allow that peer review and to support that process to happen. And we are keen for shared learning and shared experience. And to that end, we have fortnightly closed CCD governance meetings and fortnightly closed APCC governance meetings. So that equates to essentially a monthly governance meeting in a safe space where cases can be reviewed. And they usually generate lots of discussion and sharing of learning. In addition to that, each team also arrange training sessions where they drill and discuss various aspects of their role. And I'm just thinking back to the question and the framework for clinical decision-making. And whilst what we described as an autonomous role, they all, and it clearly is, they also have a support mechanism available and top cover if they're required, you know, so they're not on their own. And they've got a support mechanism. We have a support mechanism in place for them whenever they're on duty that they can get top cover.
So Martin, could you, just pivoting slightly, could you explain what STAG is and its importance to trauma care, and also just what the SAS or Scottish Ambulance Services relationship with STAG is?
Yeah, of course. So STAG stands for the Scottish Trauma Audit Group, and they've been auditing trauma in Scotland since actually around 1992. And this work ceased in the early 2000s, but recommenced again in 2011. And STAG is now part of Public Health Scotland, which is Scotland's public health body. And they have a number of Scottish national audit programmes or SNAP programmes, and STAG is one of those audits. So what that means is that STAG are responsible for collating trauma data in Scotland. They're responsible for auditing trauma data and measuring compliance against standards of care for the Scottish Trauma Network. There's a number of key performance indicators or KPIs that are aimed at measuring all aspects of care and guiding improvement. And that's from the pre-hospital element right through to rehabilitation. And for us, that includes how we triage patients, whether or not we're pre-alerting, and some of our interventions, such as the administration of TXA or prophylactic antibiotics for open fractures. And from a Scottish Ambulance Service perspective, we have access to that STAG data on a Tableau dashboard. So sort of live data, unpublished data, and that's for internal audit and improvement work. And that's really, really useful for us and for me in helping us audit and focus our areas of improvement. STAG have a steering group, and I currently represent SAS on that group, and thus I contribute to the annual audit or report, of which there was one published this year, August 2023.
That's fantastic, Martin. And what that speaks to really is that baseline of understanding and shared situation awareness about compliance and where you are with compliance to not only drugs, but also, like you said, you could speak to this, but monitoring of pain would be a classic example. Is there an effective monitoring of pain at baseline? Then how... is the effective intervention showing improvements in that monitoring? So could you speak to an example of maybe lag pain, actually, where the national reporting database has helped track improvements?
Yeah, of course. I suppose I'm not sure how it works in other parts of the UK, but in Scotland we have an unscheduled care data mark, or the UCD. And what this essentially is, it's a database that the Scottish Ambulance Service and emergency departments and a number of other NHS unscheduled care providers submit data into. And the UCD then links data, which can then allow a better understanding of that patient journey and patient outcomes. So STAG use that database, that UCD, to measure major trauma care. And I think that's one of the key advantages. It's actually within, I suppose, the wording of your question. It's a national reporting database with linked data. So it's used to collate and link trauma data nationally. It's so useful. So for trauma, this allows the analysis of aggregated and disaggregated data. So we can then identify regional areas of focus and share them with regional colleagues. That could be, and I'm trying to think around a trauma basis. So if an area of Scotland is not giving as much TXA than another area, or nationally we're not giving much TXA, we're able to use that STAG data to focus on that area, and I can go along to meetings. I'll maybe speak about it in a bit. I can go along to my local operational colleagues and share that with them. It's so valuable to us. And again, I'm not sure how it works elsewhere in the country, but in Scotland, everyone has a community health index or a CHI number. I've been away from England for a number of years now, but it may be equivalent to the NHS number, which is just a unique number identifier for every individual. And the CHI numbers are therefore really important for tracking care. But in the pre-hospital environment, particularly for critical ill patients, we wouldn't have access to those CHI numbers in the ambulance service. We use ambulance incident numbers. So each incident we attend has a unique number. And the key, though, and the reason I'm saying this is the linked data allows that CHI number to be linked with a SAS incident number. And that's really useful for us to identify incidents, identify patients, and audit our pre-hospital care, and I suppose ultimately guide our improvements.
So I've been wandering through some of the STAG data and looking at some of the occurrences and or incidents of various modalities of trauma. So it appears to be sort of a third of all falls. So yeah, 33% of all falls are falls from height, according to the STAG data. Could you maybe, it is a large prevalence of trauma from just a vicarious fall, indeed from a ladder or from a balcony or from quite frequent occurrence. Could you speak to how these patients are managed through the network?
If you look at the STAG data, the current the recent report, the biggest mechanism of trauma in Scotland is now falls from standing height. And that's probably in the UK as well, and that probably reflects our ageing population. However, you're correct, in Scotland, fall from height is still, unfortunately, a significant mechanism, and tragically, the biggest mechanism for male patients in Scotland. And I've had a look at the STAG data recently when the report came out, and I'm not able to break it down of the main causes. It does tend to be historically split into some of the things you've just described, you know, like intentional falls, industrial accidents, and actually up here quite a few mountain related incidents, given the geography up here. In direct answer to your question, you know, we actually don't have a specific or a separate work stream or guidance for managing falls from height. However, given that it is a significant mechanism and, you know, the associated spinal or pelvic trauma or any trauma associated with that mechanism, it is a mechanism that our critical care desk focuses on. And, you know, we don't have any automatic dispatch criteria in Scotland for trauma teams, but we certainly do have a low threshold for dispatching a red or a yellow tier response from falls from height. And I think the other element probably worth highlighting is that network approach, you know, that we have in Scotland, with the partnerships that we have as part of that network. A number of these incidents happen in remote or hard to reach locations, and therefore we rely heavily on support of our partners such as HM Coast Guard, search and rescue teams, mountain rescue, ski patrol teams. And all of our work is about, you know, trying to get the right resource to the right patient. And given the geography of Scotland, we rely heavily on and are very thankful to our partners to help with that. And that's particularly prevalent with falls from height because of the geography of Scotland. So whilst not a specific work stream, we acknowledge and appreciate that STAG data. So therefore, in the identification phase, we've got a low threshold for dispatch. We're keeping an eye on those calls, and we are utilising our partners as part of a network approach to respond to those patients.
So just also looking at some of the other reporting data in STAG, so more than half of the paediatric trauma is from road traffic collisions. Having treated paediatric patients yourself and myself down in London as part of London's Air Ambulance, or indeed LAS, they're an extremely difficult cohort of patients for a number of reasons. But could you maybe speak to, again, some of probably the nuanced challenges you face in Scotland regarding this patient population, and indeed how they're managed from the critical care scheme?
Okay, yeah. So you're correct from a percentage perspective, but thankfully the actual numbers are quite small. However, that in itself does present challenges in terms of skill retention for our standard ambulance clinicians, as well as our red and yellow tiers of responders. And I suppose it's not only the skills retention that presents a challenge, it's the cognitive and psychological demands of treating that cohort of patients. For example, finding the correct drug dosages, you know, it's different than the standard adult dose, or managing loved ones and supporting the psychological well-being of the ambulance clinicians that are involved in those cases. In terms of our advanced practitioners of critical care, they all complete a paediatric placement as part of their initial training. And in a more general perspective, the development of the Scottish Trauma Network has promoted combined training. So there are regular training sessions between our paediatric MTCs or major trauma centres and the Scottish Ambulance Service. The Scottish Trauma Network also has specific paediatric meetings where we focus on how we can improve paediatric trauma care. So looking at the different mechanisms and that, trying to work out how we can better improve that care right from the pre-hospital environment through to rehab. But the development of the networks also allowed for ambulance representation to become commonplace at those hospital governance meetings and M&M meetings. And we're often given details of those cases prior to the meeting, so we can provide that understanding of the pre-hospital element of the incident, which I think is, I suppose, historically misunderstood by some in hospital clinicians. So I suppose it may be a bit of a cliched answer, Owen, but the development of the network and that network's approach has really allowed us a more joined up shared ownership of how we manage trauma, which we didn't have before. And that's really been to the benefit of how we manage those RTCs, those trauma patients that your question was based on.
So just one more sort of modality of trauma really, Martin, before we maybe pan back and look at the major trauma in a more of a global sense. But if you could speak to livestock in Scotland, because again, like you said, there's nuanced and subtle challenges within the geography of Scotland, of any extremely rural area, actually. And livestock and animals are one of those significant challenges. Again, hopefully quite rare, but could you speak to the problems and challenges of trauma within livestock?
Yeah, of course. So in terms of cattle injuries, and that's, you know, it's one category of livestock. If I can draw it back a bit a moment, because you mentioned kind of the nuances in Scotland, and that's correct, you know. I think it's important maybe for your listeners to understand that around 80% of land, so 80% of land in Scotland is used for agriculture. And over half the agriculture is livestock farming. So it's a big industry in Scotland. And that's not just cattle, that includes sheep and other livestock. But it's big business in Scotland. So the Health and Safety Executive report that there were 27 deaths related to agriculture, forestry or fishing in the UK in the last year, but six of those were in Scotland. And whilst those numbers of fatalities, six fatalities in Scotland, you know, that might appear small, there's around 11,000 non-fatal injuries related to agriculture in the UK every year. So for those of us working in pre-hospital care, this is important, and it's important to have an understanding of this. And it's probably worth a podcast of its own. And I'm certainly not an expert, but the main causes of fatality in the agricultural industry in the UK in the last year were falls from height, being struck by an object, being struck by a moving vehicle, and contact with machinery. But injuries caused by animals, as you've alluded to, has been the most prominent. It's the most prominent cause of death in the UK, and most of those were involving cattle, women, you know. If the numbers still appear small and being injured, you know, being injured by a cow, if it still doesn't sound significant, in comparison, we know that shark attacks, for example, get, you know, a lot of press. And from what I can read from having a read around the animal-related industry incidents, there was only one reported shark fatality in Australia in 2022. So when you look at it that way, you know, six deaths related to cattle in Scotland, one shark and related death in Australia, you know, it does become quite a significant mechanism. My colleague David Carson, who's one of our EMRS retrieval practitioners, did some work on this a few years ago, and on reviewing the literature, he identified some really useful risk factors. And firstly, cows are big. You know, that might seem a silly statement to make, but if you've not been up close up to a cow, I don't think you can really appreciate the size of them. And they can weigh more than a car. And actually, that's probably not a bad analogy. So if you think of the energy transfer involved in being hit by a car, being struck by a cow is similar, with the similar potential for, you know, crush injuries, fractures, tissue damage. And farm working in Scotland can all often involve working alone in some isolated and difficult environments. That ties in a bit to what we're talking about earlier about falls from height, and you know they may be difficult to access, and that lone worker or the isolated environments can lead to difficulties or delays in calling for help. So there may be a delay in getting those patients, so that's important. And you know, it's not uncommon for agricultural workers to be out on their own all day, so it might not be noticed that they're missing, or they may be delaying or raising that alarm. So they may be finding these patients a long time after the accidents happened. And again, whilst there's a vast range of ages in agricultural work in Scotland, most of the injuries do occur in the over 60s. So that brings into consideration that elderly trauma element that you've probably talked about in a podcast previously. You know, and you think about that early trauma along with those mechanisms and that injury transfer that we just talked about. And, you know, if we think about those elderly patients, just in general, so they have that stoicism in the older generation. And that's probably magnified tenfold in our farming community. And this is, you know, it's really important, although anecdotal, you know, if a farmer has been injured or is in pain and is seeking help or called for the ambulance, it's kind of a red flag for us. They don't complain. They don't call ambulances. They tend to get to hospital themselves. So, you know, if they call an ambulance, it's a flag for us. Obviously, agricultural injuries, animal injuries, is that increased risk of wind infection. What does that mean for us in Scotland, though? And, you know, a lot of what we've just gone through is probably common knowledge to clinicians who work in more rural locations. You know, I'm an urban paramedic. So my colleagues in rural locations probably know what I've just talked about. But I think it's important for all clinicians who don't experience this area of pre-hospital care to have that understanding. Those of us, you know, who may be part of trauma teams or in roles that might be at some point asked to attend a cattle-related incident. And for us in the Scottish Ambulance Service, again, it's going back to that identification. I keep going back to it, but that element on our critical care desk, but it's so important to have that understanding. You know, I'm not saying that we're going to dispatch a trauma team or a red team to every incident involving a cow, but we do focus on those incidents, and we've got a very low threshold for dispatching advanced resources to those incidents. And I think it's important to note, whilst we're talking about livestock and cattle, horse-related trauma is also significant, and whether it's injuries at race courses, of which there's quite a number of those in Scotland, or horse riding, which again, I've got the same access and environmental things to consider that we've discussed previously. Falls from horses and are crushed by a horse is an uncommon injury in Scotland and has a lot of the similarities to cattle, and I think it's just something that we need to be aware of. And so I know these things happen elsewhere, but you've picked up on the fact of Scotland and given that kind of the amount of land that's dedicated to agriculture, you know, I think it is a really relevant point to talk about and really important that people are understand the impacts of that type of injury.
Very much so, you know, and me and you could probably also speak to, even in London, actually, the prevalence of horse-related injuries. I definitely went to a whole string of very tragic horse-related injuries and deaths from equestrian activities around the peripheries of London. But like you said, you know, if you're attached to one of these calls, that they often are not insignificant, and the injury load is profound, and the consequence is profound as well.
One trauma going in it, so it's hard to identify initially. It's a bit more subtle, and that's when you go back to thinking about assessment of pain and that thorough but rapid patient assessment, because you know, yeah, it's not the often there's not legs or limbs out of place. You know, it's that subtle blunt trauma.
Martin, I'd like to pivot slightly and look at the intervention, or indeed the inception of the major trauma tool within Scotland. And since its inception, I just wanted to ask around if you've seen sort of a decrease in variation of under or over triage, and how the implementation of a trauma tool has sort of benefited the trauma network.
Yeah, so the Scottish Trauma Network have an adult and paediatric major trauma triage tool. So they're not owned by the Scottish Ambulance Service. They're owned by the Scottish Trauma Network. It's probably important to say that. However, they're predominantly, of course, used by the Scottish Ambulance Service because we're in pre-hospital care. But some of our other partners, you know, like the Coast Guard, would use them in Basic Scotland and other responders. But we did put a lot and continue to put a lot of effort into ensuring that our ambulance clinicians, our crews, have an understanding of those tools and why they're important and how they work. And it's quite some nice guidelines that for trauma that we should be, you know, using a triage tool to help us triage patients. The general principle during the planning phase of the network was in Scotland was that the documentation of the use of those tools on our EPRF system would be the primary method for analysing how those tools were working. And, you know, just for a variety of reasons, it's just not worked as well as what we hoped. You know, we introduced them as an evidence-based guide to support clinical decision-making. And they're being used in real time, but the retrospective format on our EPRF system for documenting them is, I would have to admit, it's not the most user-friendly. And in addition to that, we've had some data linkage issues. I've spoken to a number of colleagues around the UK, and you know, the documenting of the triage tool is kind of a common problem. So it's quite hard to actually just document the different elements of the tools that are triggering or not triggering. However, you know, the aim of the major trauma triage tools is to get the patient to the most appropriate hospital for their injuries. You know, get major trauma patients to trauma centres. And thanks to that STAG data that we were talking about earlier, there are other ways of measuring this or understanding this. And STAG measure the hospital type that the trauma patient were first conveyed to. And by that, I mean, was that first hospital a major trauma centre, a trauma unit, or a local emergency hospital? And the STAG annual audit, which was published this year, shows that there is an increase of around 8% of major trauma patients with an injury severity. So that's patients with an injury severity score of above 15. There was an 8% rise in those patients being conveyed to major trauma centres since the network went live. Similarly, though, and importantly, there's been a decrease in major trauma patients being conveyed to trauma units and local emergency hospitals. And for minor trauma, there's also been a decrease in those patients being conveyed to major trauma centres and an increase in those patients being conveyed to trauma units. So if you put that all together, you know, things, it seems to be that the patients are going in the right direction. The patients are going to the right place. And given the geography of Scotland, you know, we're never going to get all of our patients to a major trauma centre directly or in some areas, even to a trauma unit. And that's why we have the network. But I think what I would like to better understand is, you know, we're not there yet. And we're still a young network. And there are some patients, some major trauma patients, who are within a reasonable distance of a major trauma centre. And in Scotland, we're using 45 minutes. There's still some patients that are not being conveyed to the major trauma centres. And what I need to do and what we need to do in the ambulance service is to get a better understanding of that, why those patients aren't going there. So we can support ambulance clinicians to make the right decisions and get those patients to major trauma centre. There are going to be reasons, you know, it could be airway compromise or something like that, and they're going to just scoop and go to the nearest, but we need to understand that. So I think to summarise your question, we do and rely on our major trauma triage tools. They are fundamental to the pre-hospital element of the network. The analysis of them hasn't worked as well as we are, hasn't worked as we planned. However, the different data streams that feed into STAG are allowing us to see that more patients are going to the right place and the lesser patients are going to the correct hospitals. And again, we can regionalise that and I can take that back and feed that back to my regional ambulance colleagues to support development and improvement.
So Martin, just pivoting again and looking at the APPC scheme, so the Advanced Practitioner and Critical Care Scheme, you've been with the scheme from the start. It's in its fourth year of operation now. Could you speak to it? Fundamentally speaking to you, you know, it is a data-driven scheme, which was something I firmly believe in that, you know, you look at the data and you adjust, both for pathology, for skill remits, but also just feedback from the scheme itself. Could you maybe speak to what the priorities of the scheme are going into the fourth year of operation?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of that APCC TAMR programme, our priorities are to develop a bit more of a leadership structure. The team was developed out of a pilot with two advanced practitioners of critical care, and we now have a team of 20. So as well as increasing in size, the team are continuing to develop clinically. And I think the leadership structure needs to reflect that. And we have an aspiration to develop an APCC lead role. This person would lead that team and continue to develop them further. So I'm also keen to focus or prioritise the four pillars of advanced practice. So that's clinical practice, leadership, research, and facilitating learning. Our APCCs are working to those pillars at a varying degree, but I'd like to use those pillars as a focus for further development. So, you know, we've developed a team of advanced ambulance clinicians who have specialised in critical care. We've invested heavily in that cohort of staff, and they themselves have invested a great deal personally and professionally to get where they are. And I'd like to use that expertise to develop our non-advanced ambulance clinicians through education, training and support. There's definitely a need to provide some quantitative evidence of the positive impact of the APCCs, the impact they're having on patient care. So what we need to do is create more dedicated time, more non-clinical time to allow those APCCs to do these things. It's a no-brainer for me, but utilising this cohort of ambulance clinicians to develop all of our clinicians through those pillars of education, leadership and research is just the way we should definitely be going, because it ultimately will improve patient care for all of our patients, not just our trauma patients. But if I can just draw back a bit in terms of our more general principles for trauma within SAS, and that includes the APCC scheme. It's about ensuring sustainability of the work that we've done, what we've achieved. You know, we only went live here as a network in 2021, and that was during COVID, which I'm sure all of your listeners will know. You know, things are still extremely difficult, certainly in the NHS in the UK. And we know it takes time to develop networks for them to mature and evolve. And I think one of my roles as the consultant paramedic for major trauma in the Scottish Ambulance Service is to make people internally within the ambulance service and externally aware of that, that it will take time to reap the full benefits. And whilst we do evolve, ensure we focus on that APCC, developing that programme, ensure we also focus on triage that you've talked about, ensure that we focus on the STAG database that we've talked about. And it's internally from a SAS perspective, I need to ensure that, you know, I need to engage with my education colleagues and my operational teams to get their support for developing all of these work streams.
Martin, if we could just look at governance for a second, if that's okay, because as we said before, governance is a pivotal, fundamental part of any high-performing team. And just understanding decisions which were made, looking back on them with a critical eye and learning from them collectively as a cohort. Could you speak to what governance looks like within the APPC team, but also in the wider SAS, the wider Scottish Ambulance Service, in regards to trauma?
Yeah, well, from that advanced practitioner critical care perspective, it is a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? APCC or advanced practitioner critical care. We should have maybe chosen a shorter title. But we, you know, from that group of staff, we have fortnightly online meetings alternating between the critical care desk governance and the APCC autonomous governance. And this is where we discuss cases in the form of longitudinal audits or case reviews. And there's usually some really good learning points for all members of the team. And these meetings are closed, so they're seen as a safe space to chat and share experience. And they're recorded. We record them all. And for those who are unavailable to attend, and members of the team that can't attend, they can watch or listen at a later date. And each APCC team have their own training and governance meetings, and they manage them themselves, and they focus on areas that they feel relevant to their team. But in addition to that, we have quarterly red and yellow tier clinical governance services. Red and yellow tier clinical governance meetings quarterly. where we share some of that, our critical care desk data relating to dispatch, and we review some cases. And at this meeting, as well as the APCCs, we invite everyone who works on that desk, as well as representatives from the red and yellow tiers of response. So we have some basic responders there. We have representation from Tayside, from Medic One, and from AMRS, where we discuss cases, and we just try and, if you're thinking about those, that cohort of bigger sick patients. So, you know, that meeting encompasses all of our enhanced and advanced response and our identification. And I'm trying to learn how we can do that better, how we can standardize some of our response and our care. In addition to that, we have quarterly red team lead meetings. So they're an opportunity to promote closer working between our EMRS teams, our Tayside teams, our Medic One, and the SAS major trauma team. And we try and ensure that the goals align and so that we can enhance the trauma care across Scotland. And so it doesn't matter which one of those, what we're trying to get is, it doesn't matter which one of those red or yellow teams attend, the process, the interventions, the equipment, the approach is similar, which is really important for our non-advanced ambulance clinicians. They want to know they're getting the kind of same sort of service when they ask for help or when help arrives for them. For our more wide, a sort of wide Scottish Ambulance Service perspective, Owen, we hold bi-monthly Trauma Tuesday CPD sessions as part of our governance, clinical governance, and they are aimed at our paramedics and technicians. And we at those sessions, we try to get an expert to discuss a trauma-related topic. So we've had Professor Ian Roberts discussing TXA, we've had Paddy Morgan discussing drowning, and all these sessions are recorded and made available on our intranet. So we've now got a growing library of trauma-related sessions that our paramedics and technicians can dip into, you know, at their leisure. We hold regional case review sessions as well, where we pick through a case or go through a case that's interesting to trauma, and we discuss it with the local ambulance clinicians. And that aim is about, you know, sharing learning and sharing experience. And we also work closely with our education and professional development department within SAS. And so that, what that allows us to do is ensure that there's always a trauma-related element to any annual or update or any annual or update training for AMP staff or ambulance clinicians. And importantly, linking it back to that STAG data, I or a member of our sort of main SAS trauma team, there's only two or three of us, but we attend the internal regional ambulance clinical governance meetings. So we're able to share that local or regional STAG data, whether it's around triage, TXA, and get buy-in from our colleagues to improve the care we provide. And I think another important thing, which has been gold for me and really, really useful for me, is we've got a little framework or a little gang of representatives from SAS, regional SAS, no, not just from a central perspective, regional managers or clinicians, that regularly attend all of the STN and hospital M&Ms. And I think that's really invaluable to try and share the understanding of pre-hospital care, provide that pre-hospital perspective, and of course, take feedback and learning. So, you know, if one of my colleagues goes to one of the M&Ms in the north of Scotland and they've got a particular issue, what I now know is, or it's easier to find out, is that happening in the Scottish borders as well, which, you know, previously we weren't able to do that. So we've got a little network of and that's invaluable as part of our governance. And finally, something that I'm extremely passionate about is patient outcome information. And I don't think we can learn as developers and develop as clinicians unless we follow up on our patients and find out, you know, what the injuries were. And I'm sure you'll understand, Owen, but, you know, I want to know, was my working diagnosis correct? Was my treatment plan appropriate? How could I improve? So whilst it's work in progress, we do have a number of trauma-related patient outcome follow-up processes in and around the country, mainly associated with the four major trauma centres in Scotland. But I just want to emphasise on that point is that there has to be good governance with those processes. I mean, in terms of information governance and clinical governance, and also really important to support clinicians who might request or provided with feedback or patient outcome information. The information might not be what they were expecting. So we've just got to ensure that the well-being of our clinicians, which is paramount.
Martin, as we're coming to land on the conversation, just a couple of more questions, if that's possible. And one would be a fundamental tenet of the scheme, a fundamental tenet of any robust and scheme which is aspiring to be excellent in its work, is around what happens when a critical care practitioner isn't there at the scene. Could you speak to some of the seminal learning points that the advanced practitioner scheme has learnt, either through debrief, through mentorship, through follow-up, that coaches the largest Scottish Ambulance Service to prepare them for when they aren't available next time at scene?
No, it's a really good question. It's a great question, and it links back to those, how we're going to develop our scheme and focus on those four pillars. But you're right, it's something that's really important to us as a program, and I know important to all of the APCCs that work in Scotland. And I think I would answer that is, I think it's important to get the basics right. And again, it might sound obvious, but a lot of focus of the patient management of our APCCs is supporting everyone on scene to ensure the basics are done right, done well. So that CABC approach, getting that done thoroughly but promptly, and that's repeated often. And I think closely related to that in major trauma is in fact that for major trauma patients are perhaps, I would argue all critically ill patients, often less is more. And it's sometimes, what do I not need to do for this patient? Clearly, there are some things that need to be done, some life-saving interventions. And there are so many variables that influence what you do on scene, such as the skill set, the distance to definitive care, or distance to any hospital. But in general, it's getting that basics right, considering what must be done and what can wait until later. That's really important. And I suppose another related point or message is about minimizing on-scene times for critically ill patients, particularly with penetrating trauma. And I've stated, some things need to be done and should be done, but we should always be trying to minimize the time we spend at the scene for these patients. And it's easy, when we've got that big sick patient, I think, to lose track of time and lose that situational awareness. And that's one of the big focuses for the advanced practitioners in critical care when they're on scene and they are, proactively sharing those messages for when, as you're right, most major trauma in Scotland is going to be dealt with by two ambulance clinicians and an ambulance in a white van up here. So they're still white up here, so because they are a scarce resource. So that's the message they try to get across. And you mentioned debrief. That's another, of course, that's a key point when I think debrief is so important. And depending on the nature of the incident, our APCCs will try and hold a hot debrief. We tend to use the STOP format up here, which was developed by the Emergency Medicine Department in Edinburgh. So the S is for summarising the case, the T is for things that went well, the O is for opportunities to improve, and the P is for points to action or responsibilities. And it's certainly not the only format, but it's the concept of debriefing which is important. And it's great for our APCCs to be able to initiate this, but also to encourage this more generally when there's not an APCC around. And finally, I think it's about, another message for when they're not there is about the awareness of any support that is available. And in SAS, we have got that critical care desk where ambulance clinicians can get that clinical support. And I think your listeners should consider or be aware of what support's available for them. Or if they're in a leadership position, what support do they offer or can they provide for their frontline clinicians or teams?
So, just finally, Martin, you've been part of this journey since its inception in 2020. You've seen the maturity and indeed of the scheme, and indeed some of the pain points and challenges and its development fundamentally. Could you speak to sort of some take home messages for services, trusts, and or individuals which are thinking about starting a critical care scheme or in advanced practice? What are some of the fundamental tenets they should be thinking about and indeed be aware of as they start a scheme?
Yeah, of course, I'm happy to talk about that. And I think, firstly, integration with a system is key. You know, so in our case, that's the Scottish Trauma Network. The APCCs are an integral part of that system. So they've all had placements with the MTCs and the TUs. They're a well-known, well-respected, accepted, and fundamental part of that network. So that's key. Can't do things as a standalone. It just won't work. It won't work as well, I would argue. So that's the first point. I think it's important to foster professional relationships with other related parts of the network. More specifically, you know, our APCCs work closely with our red tier or our red teams and some of our other yellow tier responders. So for us, we've also found it extremely advantageous for our to have close links with our standard ambulance clinicians. Now that might seem obvious, you know, they're part of the ambulance service, but it's so key for them to have an understanding of the APCC role. And to be honest, we've still got some work to do there. You know, we have to remember that, you know, the vast majority of our ambulance crews will have very infrequent or occasional interactions with our advanced practitioners in critical care. But where we have been able to increase that understanding, it's really had positive impacts on the work and on patient care and how the patients are managed. I think collation of data is important, and we talked about it a bit earlier. And I suppose for us, it's about showing the worth or evidence of success of the team, of the scheme, and what they add to patient care. And whilst I've got no doubt of the value of the APCCs and what they add, given the number of variables that influence patient outcomes for trauma patients or critically ill patients, showing what one particular cohort of staff add or contribute to that, showing that quantitatively can be difficult. And we're actually working on that at the moment. But on reflection, if we could go back to the planning stage for our APCC scheme, we possibly should have decided earlier what data, thought about what data we needed to collect and how we collect it and how we could have done it differently. And we might not know that at the time on. So that's why you're asking what if someone's thinking of an inception of a scheme, you know, think about what data you need to collect to show the worth and show what value that role is adding. Because we are just getting there now. And I suppose whilst our focus has primarily been on trauma, allowing the developments of other aspects of critical care, and we've talked about it a wee bit, other than trauma has been important for us. You know, we're really having a positive impact on patient care for critically ill medical patients, such as asthma, acute behavioural disturbance. Our APCCs are attending a huge range of non-trauma-related emergencies, and we've been pivotal in developing advanced pre-hospital interventions for various patient groups and guidance for those patient groups. So it's about focusing, it's about realising the added benefits, not only to trauma, if that's what your primary focus is. I think the ability to, I know I've focused a bit on identification, but I think the ability to dispatch your peers or to be involved in the dispatch of your peers is gold dust and should be grabbed with both hands. Your peers have an in-depth understanding of your role and know where you can and sometimes cannot add value to the care of a patient. So having clinicians, having those APCCs on our critical care desk and as part of our team in ambulance control has been key for us. And I would suggest developing a competency framework is crucial. I know that the College of Paramedics is leading on some work nationally to develop or standardise or sort of shared competency framework for critical care paramedics. And you know, we're very supportive of this, but we've also been working on with our own advanced practice leads in Scotland to develop an APCC competency framework. And it's really important, Owen, it's provided that framework. It provides governance in terms of what is required to meet that bar for our trainees and in practice as an APC, what is needed to continue to practice. And so that can be used for appraisal, for reflection, and to guide areas of learning and development. And I think it's another thing I wanted to say, or I think is really important, and probably relates to a lot of my work and trying to develop schemes or programs within or improvements within pre-hospital care, the ambulance service. You just got to understand that things take time. So patience is required. So if you're setting up a new team, developing a new cohort of clinician, there are so many hoops you have to jump through. And, you know, I don't actually mean that in a negative way, as frustrating as those hoops are. it just takes time. So I think acknowledging that and accepting that can make things easier. So you need to plan, you need to maintain focus, or not lose focus, but things do take time. And finally, really important point, psychological first aid or well-being of staff is so important and must be considered at the planning stage. And I think its importance is quite rightly now becoming realised across pre-hospital care, and that is such great news. But I suppose in answer to your question, and from my perspective, my biased perspective, you know, our advanced practitioners in critical care regularly are routinely going to our sickest patients, the hangings, the falls from height, the big sick paediatric patients. But they're also involved in cardiac arrest, end of life care, dying patients. So they're involved in making important clinical decisions and are regularly called upon to break bad news and support families. This can have a cumulative impact on their health, their well-being. So there needs to be a process in place to support the well-being of those APCCs or critical care paramedics or whatever title is used. So that's definitely something that I think needs to be thought about in the section of any scheme.
Martin, that's fantastic and a great place to leave the interview, actually. And to your point, I think it's extremely encompassing to finish off on that mental health piece, because like you said, it is an essential part of any portfolio which deals with acute care, and having that release valve to be able to decompress and also share some of that burden. But listen, thank you for the last hour, Martin. It's been fantastic just to walk through the scheme, your reflections on the scheme and learning from the scheme, but also the Scottish Trauma Network and just how that interacts and plays into the pre-hospital care services, but also into the wider trauma network. So thank you so much for the last hour.
Well, listen, it was an absolute pleasure. I'm really pleased you invited me to speak and represent SAS and our APCC scheme. So thanks so much. And I was going to finish on is you're always welcome. Yeah, open invite. Come and see what we're doing up here. We'd love to have someone of your experience come and see what we're doing. So, but thank you.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.